Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
The Harper government has released its election budget with a surplus of $1.4 billion. We discuss the details with Finance Minister Joe Oliver, economist Kevin Milligan, and the McLean's panel weighs in.
Why wait for the fall federal election campaign to see our political leaders duke it out? McLean's Magazine is challenging party leaders to take part in a summer debate, and we're already getting some interest.
Some sad news to tell you about. The Speaker of the Senate, Pierre-Claude Nolan, has passed away at the age of 64. He had been battling a rare form of cancer. Former Quebec Premier Jean Charest shares his memories.
And week three has wrapped up in the trial for suspended Senator Mike Duffy. Throughout this case, there has been only one man who has been able to capture the scene of Courtroom 33. We speak with sketch artist Greg Banning about creating his artwork in court.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
Mr. Speaker, this budget is written in black ink.
That was Finance Minister Joe Oliver, who on Tuesday delivered the first balanced budget after seven straight years of deficits. In 2015, the federal government plans to have a $1.4 billion surplus, but it had to sell off its shares in GM and take $2 billion out of the contingency fund just to get back in the black.
The budget also included the government's family tax measures like income splitting, a new public transit fund, and a cut in taxes for small business, although those last two won't actually come into full effect until 2019. McLean's on the Hill put out a special episode on Tuesday, mainly recorded inside the budget lockup, where we broke down the different business and political aspects of the fiscal plan. To listen to the show or to check out the full coverage of the budget, head to mcleans.ca.
Now, shortly after tabling his fiscal plan, I was able to catch up with Finance Minister Joe Oliver in the foyer of the House of Commons.
First of all, congratulations on your first budget.
Thank you so much.
I want to talk about it. You've balanced the books, but it's how you balance the books that's a little interesting. You use the rainy day contingency fund, $2 billion of it. You reduce it from $3 billion to $1 billion. How is it good fiscal policy to use a rainy day fund just to balance the books?
Well, here's the scoop. We balance the budget because our revenues are more than our expenses. In the past, we've had a bigger contingency fund because during a recession, during a deficit, you need one. But now we have a surplus. And so if you add the surplus to the contingency fund, you have quite a cushion. In addition to which, the price of oil was at 110. Now it's about half that. And so, that particular risk has been diminished greatly. So we're very comfortable. Of course, we've based our forecasts on the advice of 15 private sector economists. So it wasn't done for political, we didn't arrive at it with a political calculation. This was based on a third-party objective analysis.
But it leaves us with little funds for emergencies. What if another Alberta hailstorm happens?
Well, we have $1 billion and we have another billion point four, so that's $2.4 billion. We're very comfortable that we are where we are. And of course, you can always make adjustments as you go forward. This is a budget with many measures. And at the end of the day, though, families understand if you take in more than you spend, you're ahead.
Critics, including the opposition here in the House of Commons, are saying that this is more of a budget for the wealthy, not middle-class families. The TFSA increase on the limit doesn't help middle-class families, neither does income splitting. That's their charge. What do you have to say to the fact that they think it's all about the wealthy?
Well, of course, that is their charge, but they're wrong on the facts. If you look at the TFSA, this is an enormously popular measure. It's the most popular and significant measure since we've created RRSPs. 11 million Canadians are subscribers. But what's interesting is that of those who've maxed out on their contributions, 60% are earning less than $60,000 a year. This is a measure which disproportionately benefits low and middle income Canadians. It's the exact opposite of what they're saying. And when I heard that Justin Trudeau would roll back that increase, I wondered why he would want to launch an assault on the Canadian middle class. He's going to have to explain that. I can't explain it.
The boost in defense spending, public transit fund, and the small business tax credits or reduction in taxes, those will not come into full effect until 2019. It'll be gradual up until then. Why are you waiting until 2019 to put those into full effect?
Well, in terms of the transit fund, this is really a significant initiative. But understand, it's in addition to the $75 billion we're already devoting to infrastructure. That's the largest and longest infrastructure program in the history of Canada. $53 billion of that will go to municipalities and to the provinces, you know, according to their priorities. This is in addition to that, and it will be available when the projects are ready. These big projects are not shovel ready. When they're ready, the money that the federal government is going to invest will be ready, and we're going to do that with the private sector. It takes a little bit of time to do that. So now, in terms of, you mentioned defense, we are continuing to increase defense budgets by 2% each and every year, and then we'll ratchet it up to 3% in a few years. So it's simply not true that we're not increasing it. We are increasing it, but we'll increase it even more later. And we're also funding right now, of course, the combat mission in Iraq and Syria.
And the last thing I just want to ask you, obviously the opposition parties are not happy with this budget. They're calling for things to change. Are you open to any amendments, and where would you be open to amending?
I think they're unhappy because this budget is going to be so popular for Canadians. But look, we have a period of public debate, and we'll take a look at it. We've studied these measures very carefully. We believe they're right. If they have any ideas, of course, we'll always be listening to good ideas.
That was Finance Minister Joe Oliver discussing his budget shortly after he tabled the plan in the House of Commons. Once again, to see our full coverage and to listen to our special budget edition of Macleans on the Hill, go to macleans.ca.
The budget contained all the key elements of a Conservative election strategy, a middle-class focus with measures for Ontario, the biggest election battleground. But arguably its key theme, at least when it comes to tax measures, was actually help for Canadian seniors. University of British Columbia economist Kevin Milligan picked up on that last element, and he spoke with Macleans Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes.
Yeah, well, I saw a lot of the focus being on seniors, and two of the measures really jumped out at me. One was the increase in TFSA room, which is, you know, anyone 18 older can contribute, but it's really a lot of focus on seniors for the TFSA. And the second one is the change in the Registered Retirement Income Fund, the RIF rules for when you have to pull money out of a RIF. Those things were loosened a bit to allow people to keep their money longer in a RIF.
Right. So if we take these two measures together, like the first thing that springs to mind for me is, are they necessary? Do seniors need another tax break in Canada? Does that make sense?
Yeah, when you look at seniors versus other groups in Canada, as a group, seniors are actually doing better than they were in the 70s, and they're doing better than a lot of other groups in Canada. And so it is a good question to ask why that would be top policy priority. Now, I should say there are always people who are suffering in any group, so it's not that all seniors are doing fantastic, but when you look at, as a group, seniors versus others, it's not clear that they'd be the first priority.
Yeah, I when I think about the time I've been in Ottawa, which is a couple of decades now, it seems like there's been just progressive work to try to eliminate seniors' poverty, make sure seniors have a reasonable ability to spend the money that they've saved for their retirement. And now, yet more, like not little, sometimes we think of the Harbour government as having a propensity to niche tax breaks, but these aren't really niche, are they, Kevin? These are quite substantial changes.
Thinking about the income splitting for seniors that was put in place a few years ago, to the TFSA rules, to other things, they're much more than niche. We're talking billions of dollars a year aimed at seniors. And the way I like to think about it is there's been a lot of effort spent in Ottawa the past few years giving seniors more tools to handle the economic challenges that they face. And I just think that maybe it's time to focus on some other Canadians and help them build the tools that they need as well.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, my parents and other people are going to be like, for example, the people who are photographed from the back of the budget, a very handsome gray-haired couple. It's featured on the back page of Joe Oliver's budget. Those kind of people are going to be unhappy to hear this being said, but if we were living in an era where there were still disturbing statistics about seniors in poverty, for example, then you might say, hey, let's make sure the budget tackles that, but really it's not the case anymore, right?
Yeah, and even among in the seniors group, the ones who have a big RIF account and the ones who have enough taxable assets sitting around that they can use the extra contribution room in a TFSA, those aren't the ones where the problems are among seniors. The people who have outlived their savings, the people who, you know, have had other challenges face them from medical to other things, you know, those are the people, those aren't the people who typically have big rifts sitting around and are worrying about when they have to pull it out. Now, you know, there's things to talk about, the right way to design the RIF, the right way to design the TFSA. But I just think about, you know, the effort and time that's spent focusing on one group versus another. Yeah. I think I'd like to see a bit more of the policy rationale for that.
Kevin, what about the claim that I've heard the finance minister make that the majority of people who are using the tax-free savings accounts are actually relatively modest income earners? I think he says a majority of seniors, I hope I'm right, but it's a majority of seniors using it have incomes of less than $60,000. How does that strike you?
Yeah, I've looked at those numbers myself, and the finance minister isn't wrong about those numbers, but I think there's a bit too much focus in his analysis on the annual contribution limit and also what's been going on over the first couple of years of the program.
Right.
When I look at the TFSA, I kind of take a longer viewpoint. And I think of how this room accumulates. Remember that people get now $10,000 a year every year from their age 18 forward in contribution room. So just think about what happens one decade from now in 2025. You have a 28-year-old who now has $100,000 of contribution room. Say this guy gets married, he's got a spouse, they're saving for a house, they have $200,000 of contribution room. Now, this is, when you look at the data and try to see how many 28-year-olds have $200,000 of taxable assets outside an RSP,
wow,
outside their house, outside everything else, the answer is less than 1%.
Right.
And so when I think about this, just even over a short time period, short meaning 10 years or so, you're going to be in a world where almost no one has any taxable assets. And so all investment income, more or less, will be tax-free. Now, some people will argue that's a good thing for the economy, that's a direction to go. Others say we shouldn't go that way. But I think that's the conversation we should be having. It's not about the short run. This is about what happens to our tax system.
Kevin, could you just walk me through that one more time? So what you're saying is that those people who have money to invest will invest in a tax-free savings account to avoid the money being taxed. And so all of their potential investments are likely to be, the income in them is likely to be tax-free. That's what we're saying?
Yeah, that's my argument here, is that people are very unlikely to have a big stockpile of taxable assets that are, you're paying tax on the interest and the dividends every year, and also have a bunch of empty TFSA room. I mean, there are some particular circumstances, for example, Americans living in Canada run into problems with the IRS if they open a TFSA. Yeah. There's some kinds of foreign assets that are a bit hard to put in a TFSA, so there are some special cases.
Yeah.
But on the whole, I have a strong suspicion that 10 years from now, the amount of assets held that are in taxable form, where people are paying tax on the investment income, is going to be very small.
So can I just sort of try to walk through some of the implications of that? So we're walking into a world where investment income ends up not being taxed anymore, which means that the tax system has to rely entirely on direct income, you know, employment income, right? Puts a bigger burden on people in that respect, or on the government to find money in that way. Is it paranoid to see this as part of a generalized strategy of strangling off sources of revenue that the federal government might get, part of a sort of small government philosophy from Stephen Harper's regime?
Sure, this is the Paul Wells hypothesis. Constraining future governments in the kind of revenue that they can raise, and certainly chops off somewhere around 6 to 9% of the tax base over the long run. So that's fairly substantial when you put that in the tens of billions of dollars that looks like. Now, on the other side of that, a future government could simply raise rates on the rest of it. But that's where it comes down to for me when I think about eliminating capital income taxation or taxation from investment income. There's two things going on there. One is that potentially you improve the environment for investment and for growth in the economy, and that's a good thing. A lot of people like that. So I'm not necessarily against it on those grounds. But on the other side, there is a fairness aspect here, since most investment income is going to go to people who are higher income. And so, you know, if you're going to move to a world where we have no taxation of investment income, I think there's two ways that you could adjust the tax system to account for that and still have that fairness piece there. One is you might tax the earned income as you're earning it. You tax it up front a bit more progressively.
Right.
Or in the back end, you capture people not as it's being earned, but through some kind of estate tax or something like that.
Right.
So that's the kind of conversation I think we should have if we're going to move to a world where we don't tax investment income. Are there other things we can do to kind of counteract that fairness piece? And, you know, that's the kind of conversation I think we should be having. And I think less focus on what happens in 1 year if someone can contribute $5,000 versus $10,000, but look in the long run.
That was McLean's Auto Bureau Chief John Geddes with UBC Economics Professor Kevin Milligan. Just to note, something Kevin discloses on his McLean's blog, he's a member of the Liberal Party's Economic Advisory Council.
Still to come on the show, the McLean's panel weighs in on the budget. We talk about the McLean's challenge for a federal leaders debate this summer. And we speak with former Quebec Premier Jean Charest about the death of the Speaker of the Senate. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill.
Coming up on the show, McLean's issues a challenge to federal party leaders to have an early election debate. And we speak with the man whose artwork has captured the mood of the courtroom through the trial of Senator Mike Duffy. But first...
It's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Associate Editor for McLean's, Aaron Wherry, and McLean's Political Editor, Paul Wells. Thanks very much for joining us. All right, so we had the budget come out this week. There was a lot of focus on this budget because this is the plan, the blueprint that the Conservatives are going to bring into the next election. Paul, we were chatting earlier about how this was going to be either a pass or fail budget for the government in terms of appealing to voters. So what did they get? What grade are you giving them?
If it's pass fail, I think they get a pass in the sense that there's a lot there for people who have voted Conservative in the past to like again. We talk about the targeted small-scale spending and the targeted tax benefits, but the big picture is kind of impressive. Employment growth has been faster in Canada than in most comparable other countries. Taxes are lower than they've been in my lifetime. Government spending as a share of GDP is lower than it's been in many years. I'm talking a couple of decades. This is a catastrophe if you think that government's job should be to grow and to do and to intervene and to act. But if you think that sort of thing, you probably already were voting Liberal or NDP. The Conservatives' first order of business has been to call Conservative voters home with a good story about why voting Conservative works. And I think they did quite a good job of making that case, at least to their own base, or at least to their own sort of extended base, previous Conservative voters with this budget.
And speaking of the Liberals and NDP, I mean, they're claiming this is all about the wealthy. All these tax breaks are going to benefit the richest people in Canada, while the middle class and poor people get absolutely nothing from the Conservatives. That's their charge. They're also angry that a lot of these measures won't come in into full effect anyway until 2019. So, Aaron, do you think that the opposition will get any traction with their arguments moving forward?
I think around the edges they may have some room here. I think there's maybe a clearer shot at this is a tax break for the rich when it comes to the TFSA expansion. The income splitting argument, I think, is a bit more complicated, and it is a bit harder for them to say definitively this is a tax break for the rich. It's funny, the government, I think, has succeeded at least in defining the terms. Like, I was doing a bit of a count this week of how often they use the word tax or taxes in QP, and it was in QP and just before QP, it was something like 90 2 days ago, and it was 70 yesterday. The government is very clear at this point. They will cut your taxes. Do you want to pay less tax? Then vote for them. I think that sets up a very clear message for them. It gives a certain frame. I think it now comes down to exactly how the other parties play with that frame. I think the NDP has already sort of played a lot of their cards in terms of, we're going to raise corporate taxes, we're going to spend money on these, few things. I'm very interested to see now where the Liberals go on that and whether they follow the Conservatives down the tax cut line or whether they try to find, again, some kind of middle ground to go at.
All right. Now, the government, of course, wanted this whole week to be focused on the tax measures and other goodies that they have in the budget. But all of a sudden, the Prime Minister's non-existing granddaughter popped up into the conversation because of the comments by Joe Oliver saying that, the issues that they may have with revenue due to the TFSA measures of doubling the limit that is happening so far down the line that it's a problem the Prime Minister's granddaughter can figure out. And that really took the narrative away from the messaging they were hoping for. What do you make of all of this, Paul?
Well, Joe Oliver is a lovely guy and has had a lot of senior portfolios in government. It tends not to be a good idea for him to riff. He was the guy who set out to demonize opponents of the Northern Gateway pipeline with that sort of sternly worded letter, which at first we assumed was written for him by someone in the PMO, but apparently no, it came right out of Oliver's office and right out of his heart. And that launched a fruitless and counterproductive campaign against environmentalists and Aboriginal groups that essentially killed the Gateway Project dead. And now the minister is saying that, look, sort of two things. First of all, problems that might arise later are none of my business. And B, the Harburg family is a dynasty. And neither of those is really, neither of those is an ideal message.
It also, I mean, it gift wrapped a response to the Liberals and the NDP. Both, you know, Trudeau gave a speech in the House in response to the budget, and the entire theme of it, or most of the theme of it, was what are we doing for future generations? What does the future hold? You know, where do we go from this budget forward? And that doesn't play to Stephen Harper's strength. Stephen Harper's strength is not vision and future. It's, I'm going to cut your taxes now. And, you know, government can't do all these sorts of things. But Trudeau is the vision guy. And I think it just, it's, you know, the government wants to almost dial it back and say, well, Joe Oliver was talking about a very specific point on the TFSAs and make it a very academic debate. But he's just handed the Liberals and the NDP kind of a perfect sort of response.
All right. Thanks very much, guys. Appreciate your thoughts today. Maclean's political editor, Paul Wells, Maclean's co-host for Maclean's on the Hill and associate editor for Maclean's. I can say Maclean's more times if I want. Aaron Wary, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
The federal election may be 6 months away, but that isn't stopping Maclean's magazine from calling for a leaders' debate. Typically, during a campaign, there are just two debates, one in English and one in French, and they are run by a consortium of television broadcasters. But with the unofficial campaign beginning after the spring sitting ends in mid-June, Maclean's doesn't want to wait for the writ to be dropped this fall.
In an editorial on Maclean's.ca, the magazine has offered to host a different kind of debate over the summer, with every major party leader invited. And it looks like we're getting some positive feedback. I sat down with political editor Paul Wells to discuss the idea.
I've been really tired for years of the notion that a broadcast, just for me personally, I've been tired of the notion for a long time that a broadcast consortium of TV stations has a monopoly on federal election debates. It makes no sense. And it wasn't always this way. In 1984, the National Action Committee on the Status of Women organized a leader's debate on women's issues. It was carried live on television like all the others. It was the third debate that election cycle. Mulroney and John Turner and Ed Broadbent showed up. So why not do it now? Especially all the more so because we're going into a campaign that we know will be months long. We know these guys are campaigning now. We know we're not going to vote until October. That opens up a huge window for us to have more democracy rather than less.
What are the issues with a broadcast consortium televised debate? How would a debate under Maclean's be any different?
We know, as far as I know, Rogers may even be a member of the broadcast consortium. So we like the broadcast consortium. But there's other ways to skin this cat. You don't have to ostentatiously leave the leaders most of the room to decide whether they're going to answer a question or not. If it's a smaller, more intimate thing with one moderator, that moderator can push the leaders and say, call them out if they're not answering, chase them around the room. And we don't have to have this thing where people send in video of themselves asking questions from Yellowknife so that it looks more inclusive and more all-Canadian. We can essentially a cage match. We can shut them in a room with one moderator and try and get some real answers and some real heat out of them in a conversation that is just more compact than the big sprawling production that the TV people put together.
And so cutting through all the spin that they throw at you during the other TV debates.
I'm confident that it's impossible to cut through all the spin, but we would try and cut through some of it.
What response have you got after you published this, or maybe even before, if you decided to talk to the parties beforehand? Have you had any response from the federal parties?
We've heard from senior people in more than one party who are very interested in this proposition. And we're not going to negotiate in public. My understanding is that's the way it's not done. But a plural number of parties are already interested in this thing. And so much the better. I mean, if we were offering a chance for political parties to put their message to the Canadian people during the long run-up to this election and nobody was interested, that would be shocking. And it's not the case. People are very interested.
Why June 15th as the start date for you? I mean, the writ is likely going to drop in the fall, so why does McLean's want to have it so early in the process?
June 15th is essentially an approximate date for kind of when the House is going to rise, because they always make that up as they go along. They've been campaigning for all intents and purposes since the autumn. After the House rises in this in June, it certainly won't come back before an election, which means that's essentially the beginning of the real election campaign. And we don't want to wait until the formal writ period, because that's already scripted down to the last inch by all the parties. They all have their tours. They all have places they want to go and things they want to say. So we're going to say, fine, TV gets the formal writ period. But during the long run-up to the writ period, basically during the summer, look, if you guys aren't doing anything better, we'd like to have a debate. Why don't you come and join us?
Would you have a live audience for this, or are those details that you would work out a little bit later?
My personal preference, we would talk to the parties about this. My personal preference is that we avoid an audience, because you end up spending your entire time worrying that the audience is going to applaud, or getting mad at them because they applaud. Or the audience will be the Canadian people, and the Canadian people will have access to it the way they get access to an awful lot of their information on TV and the internet.
Well, what about the makeup, the leaders who can or cannot take part in this? Are there any thoughts from McLean's on this?
Yeah, I mean, we're not wedded to any format, but our sense of this is, since we're in this weird world where there are now six recognized parties in Parliament, including the Bloc Québécois, which most people have forgotten about, and Force et Démocratie, which almost no one has ever heard of, we're going to keep it relatively intimate. The Conservatives, the official opposition, the NDP, party that's been leading in the polls, the Liberals, and Elizabeth May from the Green Party. And as we say in our editorial, if other people don't like that format, that guest list, and those rules, they are welcome to suggest alternatives. Other organizations already are. The TVA Network in Quebec is proposing a French language debate with no English and with leaders that they invite. It's far from guaranteed that Elizabeth May will be invited to that debate. That's fine. I think what we want to do is move from a model of a monopoly that nobody ever appointed to a spirit of the more the merrier.
Would more debates in an election campaign actually help some parties or hurt some parties out of all of this? I mean, there has been discussion already publicly about this issue.
Leaders always like debates in the abstract and are sometimes nervous in the concrete. Stephen Harper is notorious for avoiding debates, both himself and his candidates. Going back to the 2002 by-election in Calgary that sent him back to Parliament as the Canadian Alliance leader, he skipped every candidate's debate in his riding in that by-election. There is speculation that Justin Trudeau is nervous about having as many debates as his opponents want. There's speculation that his opponents are really eager to try and put him on the spot by having as many debates as possible. Let's find out. We would be very happy to see Mr. Trudeau at our debate, just as we're happy to see the other leaders that we've invited.
That was McLean's political editor, Paul Wells, discussing the magazine's challenge to party leaders to take part in a debate before the writ is dropped.
Still to come, we hear from former Quebec Premier Jean Charest about the death of his friend, the Speaker of the Senate, Pierre-Claude Nolin, and we speak with the sketch artist of the Mike Duffy trial.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Well, the week ended with some sad news. The Speaker of the Senate, Pierre-Claude Nolin, passed away Thursday night at the age of 64 after a five-year battle with a rare form of cancer. Nolin was appointed to the Senate in 1993 but became the Speaker in November.
To speak more about Nolin's career and who he was as a person, political editor Paul Wells spoke with Nolin's friend and political colleague, former Quebec Premier and former leader of the federal PC party, Jean Charest.
When I heard that Senator Nolin had passed away, I thought of you immediately because you and he worked together so closely around the time of the 95 referendum when you didn't have an awful lot of company in Ottawa. You were the leader of a very small conservative caucus. And he was essentially your right hand, but I'm sure your association with him precedes that and continued afterwards. What can you tell us about Senator Nolin?
I met him for the first time in 1983, and it was the leadership race of the Progressive Conservative Party. he was organizing for Brian Mulroney, and I was organizing for Joe Clark, in particular in the eastern townships of Quebec, where I was from as a young lawyer. And we met at the meeting to choose the delegates to go to Ottawa. And at that time, he was a very imposing figure, a young, he himself a lawyer, physically imposing, intimidating. And we got along okay, but we locked heads that night on the delegate selection process. I'm glad to report that I won that battle, but I also learned that he was a pretty formidable political organizer. Then the years of government, we crossed paths regularly, and where we really started to work much more closely together was the 93 leadership race, where he was my organizer in the province of Quebec, and followed by the referendum of 95, where then he was the organizer on our side for the small band of soldiers that we had in that referendum campaign, and then the 97 federal campaign, of which he was also the organizer in Quebec, and which, by the way, we did fairly well. We picked up 5 seats and 23% of the vote. So that's the path that we are on together.
It's interesting hearing the sort of outpouring of respect and affection for the guy since he passed away last night, because as you may agree, he wasn't a glad hander. He wasn't kind of a guy who was quick to chuckle or anything like that. He could be a tough guy to lose an argument to. And he was always very serious about the files he dealt with. But people warmed to him pretty much unanimously.
Because they got to know him, and he was very much out of the norm. You know, he was not a typical politician. He wasn't a glad hander. He wasn't someone who tried to ingratiate himself to the leadership at the time. He was very much an independent speaker, and through time he became a very original type of politician. It is interesting that as a progressive conservative, for example, he would be interested in the issues of legalizing drugs. Mm-hmm. And certainly no one in the caucus back then thought that this was our agenda and our issue. But he thought it was. He thought this was something important. And he took his role seriously in the Senate. He thought, you know, this is important work that deserves important attention. Now, he was named very young, at 42, and there was reason to believe at the time that he would, you know, be a bit of a dilettante at 42. He's in the Senate. There's no election or accountability, and he'll, you know, he'll hang around. But he didn't do that at all. He took his work very seriously and showed up, and he put in his time.
When the Progressive Conservative and the Canadian Alliance merged, he became an important ally to Stephen Harper. It seems to me they would have been an odd fit. They didn't. There would be issues that they would have a hard time agreeing on. Did you ever talk to either of them about that relationship, or did you just observe it from afar?
Well, I observed it from afar. Mm-hmm. But and now to understand that, you have to back up a bit. Remember that Pierre Claude is part of what we would call in Quebec les vieux bleus, the old blue, you know, conservative tradition in Quebec. His father was a conservative, as my father was a conservative. And the roots of his political militancy go way back. And this has a very strong nationalist bent to it. I mean, it isn't just about, you know, fiscal conservatism. This is on language, on the respect of the autonomy of Quebec, the view of federalism. And it starts from the premise that if you're a Quebec politician, you're going to have to fight harder than others to make sure that you are well represented in Ottawa. So he was always, that's where he was, and that's where he started. So it would be a bit of an unusual fit with Mr. Harper. But, you know, he was very independently minded. I can imagine that he would speak truth to power. He would say what's on his mind.
Okay. And the other thing that's interesting now, the unfortunate moment of his passing is that it happens during the Mike Duffy trial, when sort of public outrage about the goings-on of the Senate is at a crescendo. And then this guy kind of reminds us of the good work that gets done and the good people who are there. It's an interesting contrast.
A very interesting contrast, because Pierre Claude believed in the Senate as an institution, and he felt comfortable in that position because he put in his time and did his work and could speak from a position of confidence about the work that's being done in the Senate. And so that's a strike. The other thing, you know, with a bit of, you know, perspective on the Mike Duffy story and other stories, what we're looking at objectively is a story about expense accounts. Mm-hmm. Now, is there anything more, you know, ordinary? I'm sorry to put it that way. I don't want to diminish whatever was done. But, you know, expense account stories are everywhere in every organization at every level. I mean, there's always someone somewhere who stretched the envelope. And here you have a situation where an expense account story would want us to question the viability or the future of an institution that's at the foundation of Canada. That it isn't working the way we want it to work, Paul, by the way, but from anyone's perspective who knows anything about federalism, this is extremely important that this Senate of ours be changed in a decent and good way and for the interest of Canada, not just scrapped because there's an expense account scandal. I mean, the world... We shouldn't be making decisions that way. And Pierre Claude saw it that way and said, no, wait a minute. I mean, there's more to this than just, a story about expenses. We should be looking at the bigger picture.
That was Jean Charest discussing the death of Senate Speaker Pierre Claude Nolin.
The trial for Senator Mike Duffy has wrapped up its third week with some discussions about just how long the case may be before the courts. It's clear the defense and Crown lawyers are taking as long as they need with witnesses. The defense is now suggesting the court follow the original schedule but add dates in the fall, which could put it in direct conflict with the federal election. The judge, the court scheduler, and the Crown will all have to coordinate before setting any final dates. No matter when they come back, there's always going to be one person in courtroom 33 setting the scene of the trial for the whole country. His name is Greg Banning, and he's the sketch artist hired by a consortium of media outlets to literally paint the scene for Canadians. I was able to meet up with Greg at a coffee shop during a break in the trial to discuss his art.
Walk us through what it is that you do when you're sitting in the courtroom.
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess what I do is I have to capture the scene or what is happening in the courtroom that would make it interesting for the readership or the people in watching the news to sort of identify the cast of characters.
So how is it that you do that? What goes into the decision making about, you know, the character that you choose for the, I shouldn't say character, but person that you choose to put forward in your artwork?
Well, I think it comes down to what's happening at that moment in the court. If it's a new witness, I would concentrate on doing the witness. If the Crown and the defense team are going back and forth, I think I'd like to capture that. And obviously, you want to capture Mike Duffy as well. He's a very important person in this trial, I guess. And on top of that, the judge.
When you decide on who you want to portray for that given day, do you wait for certain moments? Do you take almost like a mental picture so that you can begin your sketch right away? Or is it a flowing process that happens through the whole day? What is it there for you?
You probably described it better than what I can do, but I do take a mental picture. I only have a certain amount of time to get my work done, and I have to get a color copy out to all the news agencies by 4 o'clock. So I tend to do a pencil sketch, and you're right, I kind of select sort of a pose that I witnessed, and I try to add detail, and I try to add some sort of drama to it, if I can. And then I take the sketch out, and I head up to Global News, and I color it, and I send it out to everybody.
I mean, you must have some difficulties with that, though. People don't stand still in a courtroom. It's not like you have a long time to really capture that image. So do you have some difficulties? What challenges do you face when you're in the courtroom sketching?
Well, that's the excuse I use all the time. But that is the difficulty, is the fact that you don't necessarily have somebody staying in one particular pose for the whole time you're drawing them. There's quite a lot of movement that people aren't aware of in the court. People looking down, people looking up, lawyers going back and forth from desks, moving their hands, different things like that. So I just try to do my best just to do the best drawing I can.
Over your time as a court sketch artist, have you had people who are not pleased with the portrayal that you gave of them?
Yeah. yes, that's happened. And honestly, I know when it's not going well, so I don't blame them. But
have they talked to you about it? Have people like actually come up and said, "I don't like what you did"?
Oh, you're going to get me into trouble. But yeah, some people communicate what they think of the drawing, and I'll just say communicate. And I try to do my best, and I don't want to offend anybody at all.
Do you get a chance to really go over it again, or is it just so fast-paced that you just have to get it out there?
Well, that is the main challenge, actually, is that I basically had to put pencils down at 4 o'clock and send it out. So, as a finished illustrator, of course I want to spend as much time as I can to make a beautiful drawing and an illustration and make everybody happy. But unfortunately, this is the challenge, and for me, it's kind of a shakeup as well to do the best I possibly can within the amount of time that's given to me.
Do you enjoy the challenge? If you don't have the time to make it all perfect, do you at least enjoy the challenge of having to work, having to sketch your artwork in a fast-paced environment?
Yes, I do like the challenge most days. Because it's very different for me. Normally I would work out of home and I would take my time on certain projects to always go back and correct things and revisit things. So this is very exhilarating.
So in other ways, a major national court case is your way to just get out of the house?
that's kind of interesting. It at the beginning, yes, but I was actually quite honored when people chose me to go ahead as a pool artist on this job, and it's the great thing about being the court artist is you're part of the experience, and whether this is going to make an historical difference in our country or not. I'm glad to be there.
That historic part of it, this is a very unique and significant case in Canadian history. We've never had something like this happen with a sitting senator. How proud are you of that fact that, your artwork will be remembered for a very long time as a result of the significance of this case?
Okay, I'm going to quit today, actually. No, I don't know. I try not to even think of that, honestly. I just want to, do my job. And if I thought of that, I think I would choke. So I
won't bring it up again.
Okay, thank you.
That's Greg Banning, the courtroom sketch artist for the trial of Senator Mike Duffy.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.